Yeah, I'm sure those 800,000 federal employees are just really sick of all that winning with their no paycheck.
Right.
I mean, this whole presidency, this administration has been a gift. If you are a psychopath who's always wondered what would happen if we made a senile, delusional, intellectually non-functional piece of human garbage the president of the United States.
That segment of the population is just enthralled. They are so excited about this, yeah.
Hello, and welcome to State of the Revolution. Today in the studio, we have Mara Zumber.
Hello.
Ross Fisher.
Hi.
And Benjamin Klon, our kick-ass producer. I'm Leon O'Sharon. There he is.
Hey, Ben.
Hey. What's going on?
Awesome. I'm Leon O'Sharon. We have a lot to talk about today, so let's jump right into it. So first of all, Whitmer issued a number, I think there were 10 of them, executive directives, which is not exactly the same thing as an executive order. Ross, you want to take us through what that's about and what we need to know about these orders, directives?
Sure. So, well, things in D.C. are moving at a pretty slow pace. Governor Whitmer decided to get busy and crank out 10 executive directives in her first week in office. And they're a little bit different than executive orders. Directives are really intended to set policy for state agencies. They don't have quite the same force as executive orders do at the state level. But some good stuff in the 10 directives to state agencies. You know, one, strengthened protections for LGBT workers within state government and state contractors and services the state provides. And another one aimed to tackle the gender pay gap between men and women. It banned the state from asking about previous salaries and hiring, which could really further that goal. I'm not seeing the one I wanted to see, which is Executive Directive 2019-11, which would instruct Republicans to stop doing everything that they had planned to do over the next 2 years.
The executive doesn't have control over the legislature that way.
Yeah, so. I wish that would be nice.
No.
I
can't be partisan on that one. No.
Okay, you're fair. Okay, fair. Yeah, that one might go the wrong way eventually. Yeah.
Totally. But consider the federal government.
Yes, that's true. So I think there's some good things that can come from these directives. I think, you know, Whitmer isn't going to have a lot of success getting anything progressive accomplished with the legislature. You know, the Senate and House are both still firmly, you know, pretty right wing. I mean, there's been some gains made by the Democrats, but I think she's using some of her executive authority to try to and be incrementally work on some of these goals, which I think is a good thing. I'm not, you know, expecting these to be drastic changes, but I think, you know, when you have this type of power and you want to advance some of these goals, I think it's a good thing to do. So I applaud her efforts in this.
Totally applaud her efforts. I think there's two things here that I want to say about this. One is, one of the things that this shows us is the gap in the way that Republicans and Schneider ran the government. It gives nerds a bad name. That these are the kinds of things that somebody has to come in and say, hey, you know, we shouldn't discriminate against women, in pay scales, and you know, we should have decent protections for LGBT workers in the state government. And, state employees should not use personal emails to conduct state business. Holy crap, have we not been watching national politics for a while?
Right, or like state employees required to report imminent health threats to a chain of command. Like, clearly that he did not do well with any of the imminent health threats to our state while he was governor, to be quite honest.
Right. The number of problems tried to well, they're still working on getting rid of this ridiculous workaround for a foreign company for their Line 5 thing. That's just, I mean, it's literally right. just waiting to give us a gigantic problem in the Great Lakes. It's just ridiculous. So the thing about, you know, the gap that was there under Schneider's under Schneider's rule. The other thing that I wanted to say, you were saying that you don't think that she's going to be able to get much done through the legislature. I actually, just after the election, we had Yusuf Rabi on the show just after he had been elected to be the new floor leader. And I asked him that question. I said, what do you think is really possible in the legislature, even though you have, you know, the governorship, because the both houses of the legislature are still a majority Republican. And he said, you know, that there are some things that he thinks that can get done, particularly on infrastructure. You know, that would be a good thing. You know, we, you know, progressives.
Hashtag fix the damn roads.
Yeah, hashtag, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which, I mean, well, you know, during the campaign, I was thinking that might be a reason why she's running on that, is that that's actually something that might happen in the legislature she's likely to get, given the fact that we pretty much knew it was going to be majority Republican still because of all the gerrymandering that they did. So I think there's some possibilities there, but I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff, obviously, that's not going to go very far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, on the infrastructure point, I think it would be great. I think with how anti-tax or, you know, the Republican Party still is, mm-hmm. especially in Michigan, and it really anti finding any creative ways to generate revenue for the state, you know, it's going to be, I think it's going to be a challenge, but, you know, at least having her focus and leadership on that issue, you know, could maybe push the ball forward a little bit. So, mm-hmm. So hopefully.
If she uses her power really to get at the press and push public opinion in the correct way, mm-hmm. yeah, I think it would.
Sure. Well, yeah, I think that, I mean, and I think actually, you know, we're going to talk a little bit later about how being full-throated in support of a policy that you believe in, even if you don't have the power to actually make that policy happen all at once or right away, or even to start making it through the legislature or start or chip away at it over time, even if you can't start that process yet, full-throatedly going out there and after it and bringing the support with it and getting people to recognize that there's a constituency for these proposals, universal single payer, which Whitmer avoided campaigning on.
Right.
I think that one of the things that I'm concerned about is that, yeah, she'll work with the legislature to get the stuff that, you know, she made the big splash about in the campaign, fix the damn roads, like Ben said. But I'm curious to see how much she's going to actually go and push, you know, more progressive policies that she said at one level or another that she supports. I don't know how willing she's going to be to do that, given what we've seen so far, that, you know, she was, you know, really timid about that in the election.
I don't remember when she was campaigning on fix the damn roads, was she referring specifically to roads, or was that in reference to like a full infrastructure plan? Because like, does fix the damn roads include fix the damn pipes in Flint?
You know, I don't remember her connecting those two, but she may have. I don't know. Does anybody else?
Yeah, well, I think she did propose, I think, a version of like a state infrastructure mm-hmm. bank, which I think would also address water infrastructure, if I'm not mistaken. So mm-hmm. there was, you know, her plan, I don't think, was not as comprehensive as Abdul's infrastructure plan, but at least I think she did have some policy details on right. some fund, you know, ways to fund. She's also floated ideas about bonds to fund infrastructure. I think that, yeah, this could be an issue that if she really, you know, starts pushing on now, you know, could, like you said, might not come to fruition this term, but we can at least get something started on it.
Yeah, I don't remember her specific statement on it, but I'm sure that she was in favor of fixing the pipes in Flint. I know that she did stuff on that, but I don't know that you connected them. The infrastructure bank is a good idea, depending on, you know, how you set it up, whether it's set up to make money for wealthy people or whether it's set up to really actually, you know, do infrastructure. One of the other things I wanted to talk about is Rashida Tlaib.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, motherfucker.
There we go. Yeah, yeah.
No, that's pretty great. Yeah. So, Rashida Tlaib, the congresswoman from, Michigan's 13th district?
Yeah, 13th.
Yeah, was apparently at a bar and talking about Trump, said, "Let's impeach this motherfucker."
Yep.
She did what? Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know. Shocking. Shocking. And it's both, I find it both hilarious and infuriating. Hilarious that it's triggering the chuds, and they're real pissed off at her, like everyone on the right, uh-huh, you know, telling her to show some respect. And also at the same time, the liberals are also pissed off at her. And I find it really infuriating that we're still playing all this civility politics bullshit.
Right. Especially when, like, the commander-in-chief is, like, going around talking about grabbing pussy. But, you know, the congresswoman says motherfucker, and that's a problem.
Mm. Well, she's a woman, and she's brown, and she's
Muslim. Right.
You know,
and, you know, she's disgracing her family, and she's dishonoring them. Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, and when you have, I mean, we have, you know, some very, very, very far radical interpretations of that religion where they have, where women have actually been killed for dishonoring their family. So that's
right. Yeah, we have to understand terms.
And we have to understand that when he says she's dishonoring her family, that's in the context of people have been killed for that, and you know, in that religion. Right. That's not the religion as she practices it, I'm sure, and it's not as the vast majority of Muslims practice it. But that's a dog whistle, and he should be called out for that.
No, he definitely should be. But like, that just falls into his normal tone of rhetoric. It was like saying things like that, but like just enough that he can sly away from them on one side or the other. Like, oh, I didn't outright say a racist thing. You can't prove it.
Yeah, I can.
Yeah, you can. But like, that's his whole, like, well, I guess his isn't, he's not as like nuanced as that, but
yeah, I'm the whole civility thing is just so ridiculous. I mean, the fact of the matter is that anger is a perfectly reasonable and rational response to being screwed with.
And expressing it with profanity is completely reasonable as well.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And it's generated a ton of attention. You know, the press has like picked this up and gone crazy with it. I almost wish she used motherfucker to like cover another topic, like the motherfucking marginal tax rates or something like that.
Just keep the train moving.
Swear in front of all the important issues, so you just get the press swarming to that.
I mean, Fox News is already obsessed with them. They start swearing about the important issues. That would be like, it would take up all the rest of their 20 minutes.
Yeah. Well, AOC's tweet earlier today, by the way, do you guys know Watchmen, the movie?
That was great. Okay.
There's this scene in Watchmen where Rorschach. One of the characters has been put in prison. He's in prison with all these people that are like looking to gang up on him. And
he helped put a lot of them there.
That right, because he helped put a lot of them there, exactly. And they're gearing up to go after him, and he like stops for a minute, looks around him, and goes, "You guys don't understand. I'm not in here with you. You're in here with me." And that's exactly right, because the left is the majority in this country. The majority of people believe that healthcare is a human right and want our government to implement that. The majority of people believe that the wealthy are not paying their fair share, mm-hmm, and they want them to pay their fair share. And by the way, over in France, when the yellow vests got out in the street in their tens of thousands and made that same case, guess what? Macron, president of France, said, "Yeah, we're going to go after, you know, wealthy tax deadbeats." Okay, so this works. So the American left ought to take note. Getting out in the streets, yellow vests or whatever kind of vests we want to wear, getting out in the streets works. And we'll talk more about France later, but. just, you know, this whole civility thing. Civility is used by the powerful to suppress other people. When you know, when we used to have kings and aristocracy, they used to you know, go after peasants for, you know, getting too close to them or speaking out of turn or all of this kind of stuff. That's the same thing that they're doing to Tlaib. They're saying, we have power and you don't, and therefore you need to respect us. And I say, fuck off. This is America. We have a democracy. You work for us, not the other way around. We want to cuss you out. Sorry, you work for us. We get to do that. Now, unfortunately, you know, you don't get to do that in a business because that's a different relationship. But we elected you, and you're damn right we're going to cuss you out if we think that's appropriate.
And I mean, our first right in the Bill of Rights is freedom of speech. So mm-hmm. for them to be trying to, like, I guess, quiet a congresswoman in her mm-hmm. speech is completely inappropriate.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. As well, and actually, that's a good lead into this anti-BDS bill. You want to walk us through that, Mara? Because you were looking at that.
I was. So the anti-BDS portion is just one portion of a 4-part bill, and basically, so it's the last portion of the bill, and it's called Combating BDS, and it would allow states and localities to retaliate against corporations or individuals supporting boycott, divestment, and sanctions in Israel. And that's just, like, right against free speech in our country. That is our fundamental constitutional right.
Mm-hmm.
And our senators cannot
retaliate against individuals for supporting BDS.
Yeah.
So if someone was, you know, tweeting about BDS or, like, going to a BDS rally, the state could then retaliate against them?
I assume in terms of economic sanctions of their own, right? Like, that person, if they work for the state, no longer would work for the state. And then there could be state. It sounds like if there are companies that work with the state, they have, like, a contract, as it were, like a statement that you would sign. And if you don't sign the statement, which is still optional not to sign the statement, you could have certain things levied against you.
So for example, actually, just in there are some states that have this kind of thing that they've passed.
26 of them.
26 of them, right.
According to Al Jazeera.
Right. Well, and in Texas, there was a case a few weeks ago, or maybe a little bit more than that, where there was a Muslim woman who had been has been a teacher for decades there, teaches. I think she does. She works with disabled or special needs kids. And got her new contract, and one of the clauses in her new contract says that she cannot support BDS. So as a condition of employment, the school is trying to restrict her free speech.
Right.
I mean, that's just. And the thing, I'm sorry, this really, really ticks me off that my two senators support this. Stabenow and Peters. I mean, you know, and I want to be clear. This kind of thing is what was done in the 80s against South Africa when we were combating apartheid there, because there were a lot of people in the U.S. that didn't like what was happening to folks in South Africa. And, you know, there's a lot of people in the U.S. that don't like what's happening to Palestinians in Palestine with the way that Israel is handling the situation. And they have as much right to do that as any other American has the right to protest how any of that's going on anywhere. And I have a real problem with the idea that you're going to say that Israel is a democracy, but for some reason to protect that country, it's necessary to suppress the free speech of people in our country. If that country, if Israel cannot survive or needs to be defended by suppressing other people's freedoms, then they're not a democracy.
What?
No. They're not a democracy. That's an authoritarian system. That's a fascist move to suppress people's free speech because you don't like what they're saying.
It very much so is. And that's, like, imagine being a leftist Israeli, man.
Yeah. And that's true, by the way. Whatever you think of BDS, you know, whatever you think of Israel, whatever you think of any of that, whatever you think of the reasons that they're doing that, you may completely disagree with BDS and you may completely agree with Israel and completely not agree with the Palestinians, which I think is a ridiculous position, but that's a different story. There's a bunch of stuff going on there that's quite nuanced and important. But regardless of what you think about any of that, the idea that U.S. senators would ever put a bill on the floor to silence American citizens at the behest of a foreign country, okay, is traitors too hard a word? I don't know that it is. I don't know that it is. Somebody convince me. I'm open to the idea, but somebody convince me.
I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to put my energy into convincing that art. Like,
and especially the fact that the amount of Democratic support for this is the most disturbing thing. It's something you would just expect out of Republicans.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But
yeah,
for Democrats to be supporting this is just unconscionable.
I agree. I can't. It boggles the mind. It boggles the mind. Let's talk about AOC. We talked a little bit about AOC before with her. She is a badass tweeter. I don't know what else to say. That. She is a master of the medium.
Absolutely.
And her accolades in that area are well deserved. She's out there talking about a 70% marginal tax rate. Now, first of all, Republicans love to forget about the marginal part, because the marginal part is where is the piece that says you make less than $10 million a year, this doesn't affect you. How many of you people listen and make more than $10 million a year? If you make $10 million and $1, she's saying on that $1, she's going to take 70%. The government would tax 70% of that $1 over $10 million. So
honestly, $10 million I think is too high of a margin.
I agree.
What if we took it down to like $2 million?
Yeah.
What the fuck can't you do with $2 million a year?
The argument from the right is, well, if there's a 70% tax rate, then why should anybody do any work if the government's going to take that much of it? And my response is, well, first of all, they still get $10 million or even $2 million. I think $2 million is not necessarily a bad way to look at it. It used to be, we used to have tax rates that high and higher during between World War II and the Reagan era, when we had the largest expansion of the middle class in our history.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, mm-hmm. And there were the marginal tax rate was between 70% and 94%. At some points in time over that period.
Yeah, Mara was showing me like a table with all of the top marginal tax rates since 1913. In the last like 100 years, 49 of them have seen a top marginal tax rate of 70% or higher.
Yeah, exactly. Like for example, I'm looking at that chart right now, and from 1951 to 1963, the top marginal tax rate was between 91% and 92%.
Isn't that the the decade that everyone always harkens back to? Like, let's go back to the '50s. All right, okay, 91% marginal tax rate. Back to the '50s. Yeah. Sounds great.
Yeah. By the way, 1950 exactly was 84.36%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right.
So 51, it went to 91%.
Probably got the 0.36.
Yeah. They'll drop the 0.36. You're good with 84. Is that what you're saying?
I'd take 84% marginal tax rate. Yeah, really. Yeah.
So and this was back in the day. This was on incomes of like, I think it was 400,000 or over, or 300,000 or over, something like that.
But that
the equivalent today would be like 3 or 4 million, I think. I'd have to do the math, but that's pretty close. This is not radical. This is perfectly reasonable.
Not by any means it's radical.
What's that?
It's not by any means radical. It's like pretty standard, to be quite honest.
Right. Actually, there's a lot of economic research, and there are a lot of professional economists that say that the optimal tax rate is actually somewhere between 73 and 80%, a little bit less than what AOC is talking about. One of the things I want to point out, though, is that we used to have this argument. I mean, you know, really since the beginning, since the end of the of the Depression or the early part of World War II, you know, I'm just looking back here. 1932, the tax rate went from 25% in 31 to 63% in 32, and it stayed that high or higher all the way through 1981.
So, what's astounding to me is if you looking at this is so just before Reagan gets into office, you have you still have a top rate of 70%, and then you have the lowest I think it ever almost the lowest it ever got. It's only 7 years later. It goes all the way down to 38.5%, which is amazing that in 7 years that they were able to get it that low. And I know I've seen another documents where they. There used to also be a lot more brackets, too, of incomes. Yes. And then I think there only ended up being, I think, three by the end of 1987. Now I've grown out to a couple more, but that was, yeah.
So the point that I want to make is that when Reagan came in and started attacking the government and saying, you know, that the government isn't actually there to help you. That was Reagan's argument. The government isn't there to help you. It's getting in your way. Okay. And, you know, so first of all, that's ridiculous. The problem is that the government's been captured by the wealthiest elite in our country. And so it's there to help them, and they're perfectly happy with the government helping them. You get more subsidies for big business than you do for average families or people on WIC or something like that. That's where a lot of the government subsidies go is to corporate welfare. So this is, I mean, the problem is that the Democrats stopped fighting about this when Reagan came in. And when we talk about, hey, it's really important to get out there and be full-throated for the policies that we really believe in, whether or not you can implement them this year or not. Remember, Whitmer's argument was, well, I'm not going to be for universal single payer because I can't implement it this year. Okay, that's fine. You can't implement it this year. The way to get to the point that you can implement it is to talk about it and to push it and to bring it into the discussion and to drive that discussion. That's what AOC is doing. Right. That's what Tlaib is doing. That's what Bernie Sanders is doing. That's what the progressives in the party are doing. And I want to start seeing a lot more Democrats out there doing that. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I think that's very true. If you never bring the progressive option to the bargaining table, you're never going to get what you're looking for.
That's right.
Like, you can't push things to be how you want to push them if you're only willing to push half your talking points.
Right. And not only that, right, exactly. And if you're talking about incrementalism on tax policy, right now it's just under 40%, the top marginal rate or something like that. If you say, hey, let's go to 45, that's not a lot. Okay, no. That's not an ideological statement. That's negotiating over the price. Whereas 70% is saying, hey, as a society, we need to make sure that that people have their basic needs met. Otherwise, why the hell are we in a society together?
Right.
Okay, if we're not going to have a system where without working so much that you don't have time for yourself. Or you don't have time for your family, you don't have time for your communities. Without working so much, you don't have time to do those things. You can have a decent lifestyle. If we're not going to do that in our society, then why should anybody subscribe to this society? You know, why should anybody be part of it?
Yeah, I think the Democrats the last 30 or so years have sort of fallen into this Republican trap where anytime we talk about like a high tax rate, it sounds like we're talking about the tax rate for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, 70%, that's really high. The government's going to take 70% of my money and I'm not going to have any money. I think Bernie sort of changed the game of his focus on the 1% versus the 99%. His messaging. So if we can make it clear that this rate is for the ultra wealthy and that this is not going to... And we don't want to raise taxes on, on middle, lower income earners. Then I think we're finally turning a corner on that. And I think, putting out these putting out, you know, putting out these numbers like AOC did. Mm-hmm. I think we can finally reclaim this tax narrative that the Republicans have really just dominated.
I think it was like there's some John Steinbeck quote where he says something like, you know, socialism never took root in America because a lot of, like, you know, most Americans, they don't see themselves as a part of like an oppressed proletariat. They see themselves as temporarily embarrassed millionaires.
So Alex right. de Tocqueville yeah. originally said that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just really speaks to the fact that, like, you know, through decades of propaganda and the myth of the fucking American dream, mm-hmm. people have convinced themselves, you know, we can't raise taxes on the rich because when I'm rich, I don't want to be taxed that much.
When I manifest my destiny, I need to keep my money.
So basically, what you just said there is we're living in a casino.
Yeah,
that's the logic of our economy.
It is, yeah.
Okay,
I mean,
casino capitalism, like Bernie said that before, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, no, but I want to really drive this point home. When you have a class of people who have so much money that they never have any skin in the game in the sense of any actual risk to their lifestyle, okay, those are the casino owners. Okay, you go into the casino owner, the casino is going to win and going to lose sometimes. Sometimes you're going to walk out okay, and sometimes somebody else is going to walk out okay. But over the whole thing, the casino owners are going to do just fine. Mm-hmm. Okay, because all of the games are rigged to be in favor of the house. Well, that's the same situation you have if you're like in a business negotiation or something like that, and you sign a contract with a big company that has an awful lot of money, and then the company says, you know what? We're not going to do that project, right? We're not going to do that project. And you say, well, we have a contract. And they say, okay, sue us. We've got a legal department. How much are you going to spend suing us? Okay, as just one example. But even if you don't get into that, even if you just get into, hey, let's get a bunch of people together to put some money into this idea that I've got. Okay, well, if you've got the idea and you don't have a lot of money and everybody and you get other people to come in, they're going to want basically as much of it as they can get from you. Okay, and if it doesn't work out, they're fine because they're only putting in what they can afford to lose, and you've got all your stuff in it because this is your idea, for example. There's a lot of other examples, even when you've got somebody who's got some money that, okay, you know, it wouldn't be great if this didn't work out, but you know, I'm still going to risk it. And you have somebody else who's like, okay, you know, I've got $1 billion and this is, you know, 100,000. That's not going to affect their lifestyle. If you've got people, you know, coordinating to do a business and some people put in enough money that if they lose, it's going to affect their lifestyle and some people don't, it's the wealthy that don't have skin in the game. It's not the workers. We talk about you hear capitalists talk about you know they have skin in the game because they're taking risk and all of that. Unless you're taking existential risk, your workers have more risk because how many companies have gone out of business and then not paid their workers or not funded their retirements properly? Look at Sears?
I think Sears is doing that right now. They're not funding their pensions.
Right. Exactly. So it's. When you're in that situation where some people have skin in the game to the point of their lifestyle is going to be affected, their family's lifestyle is going to be affected, their kids' education, their ability to pay their mortgage, their ability to have a house over their head, when they have that kind of risk, which right now basically 70% of the American people have, was it something like 63% can't afford a $400 emergency or something like that? So when you're in that situation, it's a casino. And some people don't have any skin in the game, and it's not the poor folks.
We actually literally elected the casino owner. And a lot of those tactics you were describing, I was like, oh, hey, that's familiar. I know. Oh, not paying your workers after they, like, finish the contract and being like, sue me. Mm-hmm. I've seen art, like, he's done that. That's, like, that's directly his playbook, you know?
Absolutely.
Like, we literally elected the casino owner of capitalism.
Right, no, exactly. But what's worse, all of his casinos failed. He couldn't even make money out of it. He couldn't even make money running a casino. Where all the games are rigged in his favor.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, we're all trapped in a really shitty casino where we don't have the option not to play.
Yeah.
The house always wins. you know? Yeah. And speaking of which, Congress is still being paid, even though the government has been shut down for, what is it, 19, 20 days now?
Something like that. Yeah.
Unless something dramatic happens in the next several hours, by the time we drop this episode, it will be the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. And AOC had just tweeted a couple days ago that she had a furloughed worker come visit her in her office, who said, quote, "I work for Housing and Urban Development. My family is hurting right now, that I'm 3 weeks without a paycheck. But please, please don't give in to the wall. I don't want the political tool of withholding my paycheck to be legitimized."
Right. Now, this is really important. It's an important test for the Democrats, and it's an important test for the news media in two different ways. First of all, for the Democrats, an important test of their ability to not frickin' cave. Okay, because I mean, like I think I said on the show last week that, you know, sometimes, you know, if you get something good enough, maybe you give the baby a pacifier. But until and unless you get something big, and when I say something big, I mean a major piece of our side of the aisle's agenda, so to speak. Trump has said that this is a major piece of his side of the aisle's agenda. If he wants to have it, then he's going to have to give. We're going to have to talk about a 70% marginal tax rate or universal single payer. Those are the kinds of things that would balance that out. But anything less than that, and the Democrats cave on this, they're opening the door for a bully to keep beating them up with a stick, because that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to demonstrate that he can be the bully with the biggest stick and make people do what he wants. And unless you stand up to a bully like that all the way to the wall, and I mean the playground wall, because that's kind of a bully he is, and hold him there and don't give in to him, he's going to be back for more. He's going to be back for more every single time. And then the media side is, I actually don't like calling it a government shutdown, because it's not a full government shutdown. It's a government shutdown mostly of services that help people who don't have a lot of money. Okay, we've got people that are not going to get food stamps. We've got people who are not going to get government-backed loans for their mortgages. There, we've got people who are, who are likely going to get sick and die because we haven't had proper food inspection. On the other hand, the military is still getting paid.
DEA is still getting paid. Mm-hmm.
These are all essential services.
Right.
Right. So those are.
But the FDA is not an essential service. No. USDA doesn't need to get paid either. We don't need to look. No, the feces and the meat is fine.
There haven't been any problems with any food lately.
No E. coli, no salmonella. That doesn't happen.
They're disrupting the corporations and just let them get their products out to market. We don't need to look at them or, you know, check for anything.
Right, let's do this in the middle of winter so that people in the northern half of the country have no access to, like, farmers markets, even if they had access in the summer anyway. Right. So, yeah.
Right. Right. So I think we need a different word for it. What do people think? Not a shutdown, but I'll tell you what it is. It's a weapon of class warfare.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's a weapon of class warfare. And the Republicans cannot be let off the hook for this, because right now Mitch McConnell is going, well, you know, I won't bring it to the floor if Trump isn't going to sign it. The fact of the matter is that the House and the Senate have the power to override his veto, and the Senate passed this unanimously.
Mm-hmm.
Passed the funding unanimously. So, and I just heard on the way over here that Trump is saying, well, you know, I'm not going to do the emergency declaration and just build it myself like he was talking about doing. Hopefully, because somebody talked sense to his ear and said, you know, that's really not going to work, because it's not. So now he's trying to say, well, it's all on Congress's shoulders. Well, both houses of Congress have passed these bills. The Senate, at least, with enough to override a veto, because they passed it unanimously, and in the House, I'm not sure if they've passed it with enough votes, but a bunch of Republicans have recently come over to the open up the government side. I think there were four of them a couple days ago, and 12 of them now earlier today, I think I read. So this is on the Republicans. The Democrats and the legislature have said, we want the government open. Here are the bills. We voted for them. Okay. It's Trump, McConnell, and the Republicans in the House. It's on them to override his veto if they're really not on his side. Otherwise, they're on his side. It's his party, and they should stand up and acknowledge that. Or, which would entail shutting the fuck up and licking his boots some more. But that's what they've been doing.
That's all Mitch McConnell comes out of his turtle shell for. Anyway.
Yeah, he is a shy turtle.
Until you talk about like progressive policy, and then he's an angry turtle.
That's true. That's true, because he got his, and he's not interested in helping anybody else.
Right, just like Paul Ryan. Screw everybody else who needs help. I got mine, motherfuckers.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Moving back to Wisconsin now.
I mean, as much of a fucking horror show as this partial shutdown has been, and will continue to be, wouldn't it be amazing if in 2020 Trump is running for president again with the government still shut down?
That's a horrifying thought. Yeah, it's sort of interesting. Yeah, how I look at it is like, there's obviously the reality of the situation of how horrible it is to have all these agencies shut down is to me makes me want the government to open as soon as possible. But the Democrats need to really hold strong. And then there's the separate part, the political image of how it makes how it looks, and I just can't see this ever getting Trump being able to climb out of this looking good in any way. I mean, he's just sinking further and further and further down each day the shutdown continues, and so the Democrats really have to hold strong and not give in to any of these wall bullshit demands. It's only going to hurt Trump and the Republicans.
On that note, the longer he keeps this going, the more he runs the risk of pushing this into tax season, mm-hmm. and into full swing tax season. And just to your note, imagine his base after 2 years of no tax returns. They could not survive that. A lot of America can't survive that.
Imagine we've all been terrified of climate change. But what if this brought about the disintegration of the American empire? Everyone not getting their taxes, the lack of government services, and everything just falls apart.
Well, that's the libertarian's dream, isn't it?
Yeah. Ron Paul waiting in the wings to sweep into D.C.
What'll happen, though, is it's a disaster. As anybody that's thought about libertarianism seriously, realizes it. If you don't have any collective effort to make sure that that basic services are well designed, well funded, well implemented, well managed. Then you don't have a bunch of basic services, and you have a real mess, which is one of the things. I mean, we had that leading up to the 1900s. It was, we had all kinds of these kinds of problems up and down
the
financial
free market, Liano. The free market.
The free market doesn't work without proper regulation.
That's a libertarian argument.
I know.
The market will step in. Oh, the market has really it's come into play for Puerto Rico really well,
Oh, yeah. The market just rushed right in there and made sure that everything worked right?
Great. It was all great.
I thought Elon Musk saved them with his battery. Battery things.
Just like how he's saving Flint with the laptops.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Right. Oh my god.
At least he is providing children with clean water. But he could donate enough money to fund that the entire water system of the city being redone. And it wouldn't change his lifestyle one iota.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And of course, that's a demonstration of how ridiculous the whole idea that, we'll just let charity take care of stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
For all kinds of reasons.
Yeah, I saw someone bring that up online. You know, like America's like 534 billionaires. Not one of them
right.
has stepped up to
right.
fix this fucking problem.
Right.
Which is just it's proof that this idea that the billionaires and the rich will save us in their great benevolence is just utter horseshit.
Well, yeah, totally. I mean, it's just it's complete crap.
Hey there, this is Benjamin. Thanks for listening to this week's episode. What you just heard constitutes about the first 45 minutes of our discussion. If you'd like to hear the other 45 minutes, then sign up to help support the show on Patreon. Just $5 a month will give you access to bonus content like extended episodes and exclusive one-on-one interviews with special guests. Your contribution will go a long way to helping us continue the show and making it even better. You can find us at patreon.com/Michigan Progressive. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.